Mr. Felton, turn on your mic.
Okay, Ms. Frank, will you call the roll?
Mr. Felton?
Present.
Ms. Lewis? Ms. Lewis? Mr. Dyke? Dr. Loomis?
Present.
General Schwartz?
Here.
Ms. Castillo? Mr. Shelton?
Here.
President Mason?
Present.
Dr. Cryer?
Here.
Dr. Tarr?
Here.
Mr. Scott?
Here.
Mr. Chair, you do have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Franklin. Next on our agenda is approval of minutes for August 5th. Can I have a motion to approve those minutes?
Second.
Promptly move to second. Are there any questions or edits that need to be made? There being none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
The ayes have it. Thank you for that. We're now going to follow with the internal audit report. President Mason?
Yes, sir. I'm trying to see what the button. Here we go.
The internal auditor is here. She'll come to the mic. We've reviewed with her the audit plan for the year. I was just focused on internal controls and specific items that we agreed that should be looked at, and you had the information in your packages, which was sent out a few days ago. She's available to answer any questions, and what we require of you today is an approval of the audit plan.
Thank you, President Mason. I had some notes. I guess I want us to be clear that while we my understanding is while we do have the plan, and we hopefully will stick to the plan, that throughout the year there may be some urgent matters that need to be addressed, and we would have to modify that. So I think that that's one of the issues.
Yeah, Jim Dyke.
Okay, thanks, Jim. I think the other has to do my concern. We use the term prevents findings and recommendations to management, and I thought in the past we had been very clear that that is made to the board, and so we obviously have a dotted line to the president. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I think all of the audit reports would be presented to the board at the board meetings as audit reports, but my understanding is that the internal auditor reports to the president with a dotted line to the board. And she has authority and actually a professional responsibility to bypass the president if, for some reason, you know, the board needs to know something that the auditor thinks the board needs to know, unless I misunderstand the reporting lines.
Do we have an opinion from legal? Because I have the opposite impression. What's the...
I thought that it was something that we were actually going to talk about, changing that. Because I think that right now it shows that the internal auditor reports to the board with a dotted line to the president.
Oh, isn't
and
that
what we've been talking about, you and I have been talking about changing that, and we need to have a fuller discussion around that. The concern that we've had in the past is that the audits have been delayed by management.
Mm-hmm.
And that action that should have been taken in a timely manner was delayed because management did not share the audit when there were findings, negative findings. And we need to be able to have assurance that those audits are going to come to us timely so that we know what's out there, especially since we have the responsibility for that. So, mm-hmm. So it's something that this reporting is something that we haven't settled yet.
Yeah, I had a different impression.
Yeah.
You know you report to?
Legal, do we have a comment from legal?
Mm-hmm.
Smriti Ratkar, Acting General Counsel. That is actually the change that's been proposed in the DCMR that will be going for the board's consideration at the December 8th meeting, but it is something we could further research in terms of best practices. Ultimately, it will be the board's decision as to how it, what it deems appropriate as to what that reporting structure would be.
What is the language that's going to be coming to us?
The current proposal says reporting to the president with dotted line to the board. And that will be in Chapter 2 of the DCMR.
And what is it? What is it now?
I don't believe it's defined currently. There is no defined reporting structure in the current DCMR.
Krishna Saraya, the chief internal, the chief audit and compliance executive of the university. This situation had actually arisen a few years back when the district was not very happy with the reporting to the president, and so it moved to the board. This was during President Sassam's time. The district was not happy. They felt that I was not independent enough.
Did that come out of an audit, the city audit? Because, I thought that there were some issues on the board, but the board chair having some concerns, and that at that time we defined it to report to the board. But I didn't realize there was a city instruction to change that.
I think the city was very concerned during the audit time, mm-hmm. With the travel audit, and they felt that by reporting directly to the president, it really compromised my situation, and that I was not really independent in the way that they wanted the independence. Because the city, the reporting is different because they report up, you know, their structure is different, but we have a slightly different structure here.
Right. Excuse me, how did you feel about that?
Mike.
How did you feel about that? Mike. This is Gwen Lewis. How did you feel about that? Did you feel as though it was compromising your position?
I've worked in the past in different private companies, and I've had a reporting line in some instances in some companies directly to the board, and in some instances a dotted line to the board. So I have worked on both sides.
No, that was not the question.
How did you feel about
reporting directly to the president?
Personally, I did not feel any that my position was compromised because I report what the facts are in an audit.
I think that what we should do, this issue is coming up before the full board, and we will discuss it fully there. In preparation for that, it may help to go back and look at whatever those, because I don't think the city can dictate to us what the structure is. That's our job. And the city may have expressed, I think there were lots of folks that expressed concern during, the particular audit that you're citing. But, and I thought that that's when we had the auditor, I thought it was the board's decision. So I think we can research what happened then, mm-hmm. and whether or not there was something that we agreed to do or we voted to do. Ms. Franklin can check the archives for our minutes and then figure out what we want to do from there. But I don't think we should spend a lot of time at this meeting talking about what the structure is. It says it's going to come before the full board at our next meeting.
I just wanted to say, much like the general counsel, I'm not theological about any of this because she has a professional responsibility to go directly to the audit committee chair if she feels in her judgment he needs to know something. So on a day-to-day basis I'd be working with her either way, but at the end of the day it's the board's decision.
Okay, and I guess the final issue, not issue, clarification, when it involves the federal money and federal grants, those audits must be done whether they're part of the schedule or not. Is that correct?
So I'm sorry if you can just explain that.
Any federal funding.
Pell Grants is actually a federal audit, and the feds request that comes in as a single audit every year.
Okay.
That's not part of my audit plan. If there was some need to, it could be put into my plan.
I see.
Yeah, Troy Stovall, Chief Operating Officer. When we get here to item 5, audit preparedness, you'll have a report from Mr. Sanchez, Dwight Sanchez, talking about the single audit that you referenced, A133, and our preparedness for that.
I guess maybe just one other question. Mm-hmm. Is if the board, you know, because of our oversight responsibility, determines that there should be an audit, or we decide that we want a particular function or issue looked at, in those cases, does that audit, you know, does the auditor come to us initially with that result, or do they go to, would they go to management when, if we change the reporting structure?
I think it's whatever the board desires. Mm-hmm. You know, if the board wants an audit done, then that would be done, you know, no matter what the audit plan is. And if the board wants that report to go directly to the board, then that's what would happen.
Okay. So I think that's where some of this is coming from, because we actually requested a couple audits, and they didn't come to us timely.
Oh, they should have.
They came to us after things had been changed and stuff like that. That never makes us comfortable.
Yeah, and that's which resulted. Okay, we're going to not talk about this anymore then until the big meeting, and so understand that we're not approving this plan at this point.
Yeah. No, but we're recommending to the board, a motion to recommend the plan to the board. I make that motion to recommend it.
Pending clarification of those issues.
Yes, that's viable, but as a result of having a quorum, we need to take a committee action.
I just want to be sure the motion is pending clarification.
Okay.
Yeah, that was it.
Pending clarification on questions raised, I move that this be forwarded to the full board for consideration.
Okay, properly moved and seconded that we recommend that we move forward to the board, again, pending clarification of the reporting line and
authority.
There was another issue he raised. Okay.
And this is Chair. Are we moving forward with a draft, or should this plan be? Are we moving forward with a draft, as noted here, or should this plan be final from out of the committee to the board?
My understanding that it's a draft until it's approved by the full board.
Yeah, for clarification, I didn't hear any problems with the plan. The issue is about the reporting lines, and that's something we'll sort out afterwards.
And yeah. Didn't we say something about initiating an audit was a question that was also on the table in our earlier this discussion? And I don't think we have any rules on initiating an audit from the board, no. But we've done that in the past.
And there's nothing in here that would preclude us from doing that.
I'm just trying to list the issues that we would research.
Oh. All right. Okay. All right, then. Did we take the vote?
No.
Okay.
We didn't take the vote.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. Opposed?
Aye.
We don't need a roll call, do we?
Yes, we do. Don't we have a roll call vote everything?
We don't necessarily have any committee.
Not at the committee level. Not at the committee level.
Okay. The minutes can reflect it, which is unanimous, if that helps. All right, thank you. Okay, let's move to our next item.
2015 financials, and we have the Chief Operating Officer and the Office of the Chief Financial Officer here to report on those.
I'm going to turn it over to Don.
Okay, sure. Mr. Chairman, although we're not completed as yet with preparing the final financial statements, we wanted to bring forward a preliminary statement to give you an idea of where things are headed. We expect that we will complete the financial statements within about 10 days. We have provided two statements in your package, a statement of revenues and expenses and changes in net position, which I'll address first. That shows on line 40, total operating revenues of $56 million, and as opposed to $55.5 million last year, so it's relatively flat. We have total operating expenses of $126 million versus $134 last year. The change is primarily because we moved a lot of contractual services, expenses related to the student center into capital. The building is substantially completed. And so we had also from the District of Columbia appropriation, $73.4 million as opposed to $66.7 million rounded from last year. The only significant change that I wanted to point out here is also in the investment income. We've had a loss this year of $1.2 million versus $3.7 million. That is substantially related to the decline in the market during the months of August and September. Most of that has been regained since then. There was about a 2,000-point decline in the Dow Jones that had a significant impact on our balance, our investment earnings, as reported for 9/30.
Okay, these obviously reflect the numbers. I guess the committee needs to have a sense of, you know, is this yellow, green, red, what?
So far, we will not have a deficit this year, but we do have a few more entries to do relating to write-offs of the MADI receivables for the MADI contract, I believe it is, and we're still doing some work on that. And also, we have to finalize the number for depreciation, although we have, I think, a fairly accurate estimate in here at this point.
Okay. Are there any questions? Because, again, and that's the good news, but certainly maybe before you were here, Don, we were told that, and then the next quarter there was this big deficit.
So. Well, we will have ready by the time we have the board meeting in December, we will have completed financials to provide you with the final numbers.
Which you think are without a deficit?
At this time, there are no indications that we have a deficit.
I have a question. This is Whitehall. Mike. Whitehall, is this the first time that
keeps going off on me. My question is, will there be clarification as to are we measuring our risk here in terms of, I mean, somebody, I guess we do have a substantial organization watching over this money, but it just seems like almost $2 million was lost. Should we have all this money in that one place, or do we have it diversified properly, or will we get an explanation of that as we go forward?
Sure, it is diversified, and we usually get the treasurer of the District of Columbia to come and make a presentation on the investments.
Right.
We could arrange that if it's so desired for the next board meeting. Or
you're not talking about the investment problem we've been having.
Mike, we've been having for 5 years. Are we behind schedule or ahead of schedule on that audit?
My microphone was on. The district's audit of our investment is run by the district, and it's on the district's timeline, correct?
The audit is done by an outside entity.
Outside entity. There's a new company,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And they're coming in to audit. Is their timeline going to afford them the opportunity to talk with us before they send our audit forward?
The district audit will not be done until the end of January. That's when the report will be completed.
But
our report is required before that time in December because it's a part of the district's report. But it will
but
be
there's
included.
A draft of their audit of us and what their findings are that comes to us at an awkward time. And usually in the past we've asked them to give us a preliminary report prior to giving a final report to the district government. So we have some idea of what's going on. We've tried to do that over the last few years. And that new company has not been asked to do any of that.
Not that I'm aware of, but I can follow up with the treasurer and the CFO.
Well, it's up to the committee chair. You know. It's just something that we have been trying to get their calendar to be closer to our calendar because the report comes out and the negatives all come out and we haven't really been, whatever the findings are, we find out about them more after the fact than a little bit ahead of the, we're not asking to change them, we're just asking to be informed a little bit ahead of the final report being published.
Just a couple things. I think, you know, overall, when we look at this, we are, you know, looks like we are a little better than we were last year if you look at just the total asset line. But there are, you know, some things in the detail that raises some question. And looks like for non-governmental grants and contracts, we are about $800,000 lower this year than we were last year.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if we have some information about, are these grants that were not renewed or, you know, what's the difference in that $800,000 there?
It's generally, a lot of times they're one-time grants.
Okay.
And it's just a matter of going out and getting more. So, you know.
Okay. And then in other operating revenues, it's about a $600,000 difference there. And do we know what makes up that difference?
Other operating revenue.
Yeah, you have last in 14, we were 3.9.
9 million,
this year we're
and
3.3.
We are 3.3. That is one of the items that we are still working on. That I mentioned we have some things to finish up. So
okay.
We expect that the number will be fairly consistent by the time we're done. I don't believe that it'll have a significant difference there.
Okay. I mean, it looks overall, you know, when we look at the bottom line, it looks like we may be doing okay, but until we have the final numbers, we don't know for sure because we have heard this before when we're doing okay, and then boom, we get hit. I think, I'm not sure if all of the new members on the board understand the investment structure that we don't command our own investments. The city does that. And, you know, we don't really influence how they invest our money. And I think that's one of the issues that we have every year, that we really have no say in how those investments go. And so even though it looks like we've got some losses here around investments, we haven't had any ability to influence how the city invests our money. I think that's a fair statement.
That's fair, and as Trustee Shelton was saying, it's a matter of informing us so that we at least are aware prior to the end of the year.
So it's being published citywide, it's appropriate to tell.
Yeah. Jerome Shelton, it's appropriate to tell any entity when there are concerns arise or, you know, successes arise before there's a published report. And we've been always late in getting that whatever information is made public.
I think part of the problem it creates, though, for us is that it makes it look as if we are not diligent and minding the store. When our hands are tied, we don't have the ability to do that. And so I think we've attempted to footnote that or to make that real clear that we don't determine how our money is invested. Therefore, we shouldn't be blamed or people shouldn't raise questions around what the board is doing when we see losses like this, because we can't influence that. And I think that's the other part of the problem we face in investments.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead. Barrington Scott. So is there a possibility, even though we know that they do that process, is there a possibility of at least providing some options in certain areas? In other words, a recommendation, if you will, in certain areas, especially when we know we'll be heavily involved with the new student center and things of that nature. Can we make those recommendations? Not that they will follow them, but at least from our standpoint as a board, can we make recommendations in certain areas that maybe with the council understanding that there's a new change here and seeming to be a little more positive, you think something like that could take place?
I was going to see if Don wanted to respond to that.
Mike?
I'm sure we can make some recommendations to them. I'll have discussions with the treasurer's office and see if we can arrange to facilitate that process.
Okay. Thanks, Don. I think that would be helpful to at least get a sense. But again, let's be realistic. If we make specific recommendations, we need to have a basis on which we make those recommendations. And I would not want us to get, you know, out in front with, you know, just personal interests about what we should or should not do. So let's just come back to us with, you know, how is it operating, and what is the appropriate time that we, UDC's Board of Trustees, could be briefed on that, and
for Don, what extent? Sorry. For Don, a quick analysis on line 41. There seems to be a $2.5 million increase over last year.
Mm-hmm.
Just a quick analysis of
For salaries, it's primarily related to, you may recall that we got $2.5 million for the workforce development last year, which we hired, I believe, 19 more employees. Yes, that's primarily the reason for the change.
I'm assuming that's also reflected in the appropriations from the district.
Yes, that is one of the reasons why it went up.
So I guess one of the questions on that is whether that went to the base, went to our base budget or not.
That was an increase to the base, yes.
So when we look at a reduction, they'll claim that it was something else, but that money was still there.
Yes, it is.
They'll claim that.
They will indicate that it's included.
Okay.
Other questions? All right. Thank you. Move to the next item, please.
Next item is audit preparedness. There's a memorandum in your packet from Mr. Rickford, and we're going to ask Mr. Stovall to give you the details.
So we just had the internal auditor, so we've used this word audit kind of in a general sense, and so let's just be clear for everybody. The internal audit report is, again, her role is to you saw the internal audit plan that she has to look at specific functions that she's decided have things that we need to look at, and as we just discussed, those areas that the board may want her to look at. What we want to talk about are the external auditors that come and look at both our general financials, as well as what you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, our federal grant funds. In particular, it was called the A1 and 33 single audit, which looks at all the federal funds that we get from both grants and the Title IV funds. As I think this board knows, we've had some findings, particularly in the A133 area, that we are addressing. But overall, as I've spoken to Mr. Rickford, he'll give you some details in a moment, Mr. Sanchez, who runs our enrollment management office, we have either addressed or in the process of addressing and have a plan or putting the right protocols or the hires, in the process of getting the right hires to address those previous findings. So before I go to the 133, because I'll spend a little bit more time on that because you have more details, as the President noted, you have in your packet, a memo from Mr. Rickford of October 29th to the President that he will, you know, go over and answer any questions about our preparedness for the financial audit, which actually is already in progress.
Don Rickford, Chief Financial Officer. You may recall for the FY14 audit, we had management letter findings and yellow book findings. We've corrected all of those findings, including preparing comprehensive policies and procedures for the financial operations. So we expect that there will be no repeat findings from the prior year. With regard to the new year, there is a possibility that we may have a couple of findings related to the Quick Payment Act, but I don't believe that so far the audit has substantially completed their looked at items through June of this year. So when they return, they left yesterday, and they're supposed to return in about 2 weeks. They will look at items between July and September. But for the period October to June, there were no findings that were raised at this time.
And are you anticipating something being identified for the next
Well,
period?
We do know that there were some late payments. You're always going to have late payments. But what we have done, we went back in accordance with the law and paid interest. We had to pay, I believe, a total of about $5,000 related to late payments in interest. So we are complying with the law.
Well, and the $5,000 is a lesser amount than previous year.
Oh, significantly.
I didn't want our new board members to
Oh, I'll cut my mic off then.
I believe last year we paid about $20,000 in late payments.
That's actually an improvement. Interest. Okay. All right.
Jerome Sheldon again. One of the findings was that the timeline for our report, the district reporting and the federal reporting was in conflict. Is that going to be a repeat finding, or have we found a way to work through that?
We do not expect any repeat findings. We've addressed all of the audit issues that is raised, and we put in place new procedures to address all of those concerns.
I mean, you're talking about just the 2 years being
The calendar year
one calendar ended, mm-hmm. and we are fiscal.
And well, the reporting calendar mm-hmm. has been a finding for us.
Versus the academic calendar yes. with the reporting for the financial
and that,
aid.
That's been a minor repeat. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say minor, but a repeat.
Yeah.
We
have put in place a reconciliation process so that will not be a concern going forward.
Okay. Yeah. And it just Troy Stovall, Trustee Shelton, it's an issue that Mr. Sanchez will talk about as well, how we've addressed on the Title IV part of it, because that's really where the significant part of the finding is. Because, you know, our students start in the previous academic year. We're awarding them aid in the previous, and then it has to be an allocation to the previous year and the current year, and that math has to work out. And so that's been one of the challenges, yes.
All right. Again, you're saying trust me, so we'll see.
We trust and verify. This is
well, I have a month to live with that.
Right? All right, next on the agenda?
Well, let me, if I may, Mr., there's a second part to it. As I speak, I'll ask Mr. Sanchez, our manager of our enrollment management office. And so, from this point on, by the way, all the committee members, we're going to be following the PowerPoint. And so, we're looking at pages 3-7. He's not going to take you through pages 3-7. That's for your detail.
They may not be worth.
That's fine. But really, what we want to do is kind of give you the highlights, if you will, Mr. Chairman, of pages 3-7. Obviously, I'll allow for any questions. But again, just being repetitive, we recognize these findings. This is an important area, extremely important area. We also recognize that until we get this addressed and get off of these findings, we cannot start new academic programs. So getting this done, the president has made it clear this is the top priority for me. And it is a top priority, and so that's why you have the level of detail you have here in this report, and you'll see here, hopefully here in a few minutes from Mr. Sanchez, that we plan on having this addressed when they show up in the spring. So this audit does not take place, so we're clear, does not start until the spring of 2016. Okay, Mr. Sanchez.
Dwight Sanchez, Associate Vice President for Enrollment Management. In front of you is basically a praxis outlining at every level the addressing of at least seven A-133 single audit findings that hover within the areas I currently oversee. And in those areas, there were two things we had to do. We had to come up with a plan of action and also identify talent to make sure that we address these items, in particular financial aid. Most recently, we've made three hires, one for a financial aid systems manager. We've hired a new director of financial aid this past June. She's heavily systems oriented. And the issues for the last 3 years that have plagued the institution is the systems in terms of banner, in terms of cost of attendance and how we reconcile all those processes. That's one. The other thing that we've done is we've recently hired a compliance officer. and a reconciliation specialist that works with the FISAP and the Office of CFO, because the issues there were reconciliations with the ledger, drawdowns of funds, Pell Grant alignment in terms of under or over awarding. So all of those things have been identified, and we found persons to manage and also ameliorate those processes, and we've come up with a timeline to meet those things. A good example of that is currently we've audited approximately 1,200 files, and of those 1,200 files, right now they've all come back clear in terms of eligibility, in terms of reconciliation, and they're all eligible for financial aid. One of the issues we were finding is if we had a pool of 65 students, we would find maybe 15 to 20 of them were not eligible for financial aid. A good example of that is, in order for you to be eligible for financial aid, you're accepted to the institution, you have to have an official transcript with a date. So we would have files where there would be no transcript, which would then, by law, make that person ineligible. However, we would still award aid. And when the auditor would come, that aid would have to be returned to the Department of Education, because the institution has not verified, indeed, that that person is eligible. So all of those things have now been, indeed, repaired. So with confidence, we have addressed the eligibility issue. We're working with the CFO's Office for Reconciliation. We've increased our ability to report the enrollment report from the Office of Registrar on time. We have a return to Title IV under order with the Office of Registrar and Financial Aid. The only thing that we're really working on now is the systems, because that talks up, that recall, sorry, that requires building it from ground up to proficiency, which would take anywhere from 3 to 6 months. We'll be done before the auditors come in. And by then, we will have an internal audit conducted between now and January to give us at least a two-month break if we need to modify accordingly. Does all of that make sense? Yeah.
So, Dwight, great report. Thank you, Dwight. If you can't tell, he's not very passionate about this. Talk about records management work that you're doing. Residents and the residency.
So one of the issues that also plague the institution is cost of attendance. If you apply and you are a resident, there's a documentation policy that we weren't really adhering to in-house. So what I did when I was under the Office of Provost with the Office of Registrar and IT is we've restricted the ability of data processors to arbitrarily make decisions. So now that's restricted just to the office, the registrar, the director of admissions, and the person who is now the residency coordinator. So if anything's happened, we have three people for accountability instead of it being just open like that. So we did 888 files just for residency to test run, and all of those came back clear. So those 888 files were very clear. We have about 3,200 more to do, because we have approximately 4,000 students who get federal aid, if that makes sense. That's one. In terms of record management, we've just recently procured work from an outside agency that's going to cost us roughly $35,000 to come in and take all the files back from 2012 to now and index those and put them into document imaging. So the Office of Financial Aid, the Office of Registrar, the Office of Admissions, when audit begins, can actually just draw them down from a system rather than an actual file where we have them misplaced or we can't find them. So all of those things are currently in play to make sure that when the auditors come, it's there.
And let me add to that, if Ms. Maria Bird would stand up, we actually have a larger effort that we're doing, Mr. Chairman, that Ms. Bird is leading, that is looking to basically take all of our records. We have a warehouse that we've got a lot of our records in. Our goal is to, and through Mrs. Bird's leadership, we are taking an effort to digitize all of those records and begin, frankly, get out of the warehouse, but get out of those paper records, those historical paper records. So that's in addition to what Mr. Sanchez just talked about. Thanks, Maria.
Okay.
You were impressed with the last time?
Can I ask one question?
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Barrington Scott. Mr. Sanchez, we're very excited about what you're doing, and we definitely want you to continue, but how long will it take to get that rest together? What realistically makes sense?
So the audit is really from year to year. So the auditors who are coming in, is going to be a new audit team, actually won't be looking, but would have knowledge of the past findings. So basically, we're starting over again. So not only am I focusing on the past findings, but I'm also trying to think about the possible hiccups that could be anew. So all of the directors who work with me have a plan of things that could potentially go wrong. To answer your question, it will take us up until June to get it in order.
So we talked about 888.
Yeah. No. You mean in terms of what we have in place. We'll be done by January.
My man.
January.
There we talk.
I answer this. I understand the question. January, yes. Okay.
Very good.
Other questions?
So the other thing that I want you to know about this is this is the year we have to apply for recertification. So all of this is going to go into that.
Yes.
And I think we're going to probably get it right. That's my thought, yeah, in that regard. Okay?
Fantastic.
All right. And when do those folks come in for that?
So actually, the A133 audit commences in March. The actual recertification process for the institution to be able to continue giving Title IV funding, that all commences in June. And it's a process that it takes. So they'll probably come in and become my best friend because they'll be with us for like 3 to 4 months. They're coming in. They're going to sit with financial aid. They're going to sit with admissions. They're going to sit with the Office of Registrar. Then they're going to come to a determination, which is either we continue provisional status because we've made a lot of progress, or the other two things that can happen is we place on heightened cash management, which simply means if we don't fix those issues, which I don't think we'll get there, it means the institution would have to front the $30 million that we award in aid, and then they audit us to make sure we've done it correctly, and then they will reimburse us. So those are the two things that I have in my mind. We get off provisional status or the heightened cash management. So that's how I function this operation.
And so please comment on the staffing that you have now. I noticed in the report there were some vacancies.
So in the Office of Financial Aid, with the Executive Vice President, we've worked earnestly to bring it up to what the regulations require, efficiency. So it's like being a doctor. You have a neurologist, you have a pediatric surgeon. So in the Office of Financial Aid, we now have not only the director, we also have an associate director, then we have counselors, then we have compliance regulation specialists, then we have a reconciliation specialist, and then we have a federal work study SEP coordinator. Because these are all federal monies that have to be reconciled and managed by persons under the purview of the director herself or himself. So we've hired and filled those positions, with the most recent one starting November 16, and that's the compliance person. Yeah. So that's for financial aid. We needed those positions. We never had those positions before. Yeah.
And currently there are no vacancies?
Currently we have one more that we're working on, and that's the direct loan specialist. That's the person who will work with the Office of CFO to reconcile the drawdowns and all of those things that are needed, because the drawdowns have to reconcile with the ledger daily in that regard. And what has been happening from time to time is there's been delayed in when we would draw down $2 million or $20 million, because the federal government gives you a timeline by which you have to procure those funds. And for some reason, it hasn't been working seamlessly, but we're working there now in that regard.
Thank you. Other questions?
Let me just ask, these were new positions that we didn't have before, but were they already in our...
So what I basically did is a redesign. So we didn't add to the FTE.
Okay.
We just had some individuals who were separated and some who resigned.
Okay.
And I took the opportunity there to rewrite those positions.
Okay.
Yes.
Before he steps down, just one other point I think it's important. It's not necessarily an audit piece, but I think it's important to understand the other part of the Enrollment Management Office, and financially specifically, is the customer service part of it, and driving that visibility of that and improving it. We don't walk away from the fact that that has been a challenge for us. And so I want him to speak quickly on that, but I also want to, you know, make a point and talk about Mr. Rickford here, because if you don't know the structure here, the student account piece of it reports into Mr. Rickford. Obviously, the financial aid piece reports into Mr. Sanchez, but the students don't know about our organizational structure. And so the challenge is making sure that they're getting the right information regardless of which office they are calling. And so we have been working much more closely with Don and his team to make that happen, and we've done some specific things in the Office of Enrollment Management to also make this a real quick speak on that.
So what we basically did is, again, we had an existing position. We redesigned it, so that's basically the customer ombudsman in the area. And that person is the point person for all external and internal constituencies who has complaints or inquiries. That person receives it, and then that person is engaged the Office of Financial Aid, the Office of Student Accounts, the Office of Admissions, and resolves those issues, and we have a 3 to 4 day timeline in which to communicate to the complaint or the complainant or the person who's inquiring to resolve those issues. It's been working rather smoothly, but what we've come to find out is most of the complaints or inquiries that come to the unit is a matter of just not having a response or someone to pick up the phone, and so that's what they really want, because what I've found is it's how we tell them no and how we tell them to follow up what the next steps are. So all of that is now in place to get it to be somewhat operationally seamless.
One of the things that I was going to ask when you were presenting before, you know, a lot of these things that are findings and repeat findings really go to how we train and educate our staff. And so the fact that we add a new layer of monitoring and accountability doesn't speak to how we make sure our staff is ready in the beginning. And so are we also changing, or what have we done?
So this year alone, to answer your question, we had a professional development training, three particularly for the Office of Financial Aid, and 5 for the Office of Admissions, and 2 rather in total, so that's 8 of 10 for the Office of Registrar. And what that basically included, Madam Chair, was webinars from the Department of Education, webinars and a customer service consultant, people from College Board, individuals from the Department of Education who basically came in and told us, this is what you need to do, this is how you do it, this is what you stand clear of, and then Dwight, with you and your directors as you're recruiting individuals, these are the skill sets you need to look for. Don't do anything else outside of that.
Okay, and so as we identify, or if we identify individuals that may still not be performing, do we re-educate them?
Or? So we re-educate them. We've done that with 2 particular team members, but we still found value in what some activities, so we've repurposed them. Okay. And we've done that recently with 3, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Given that, again, I understand your and appreciate the fact that you recognize that has to be addressed. Is there any relationship with our students?
So we actually have
sort of assess that feedback from them.
Yeah.
We typically say things are great, and the students don't even see it.
So we're doing on November 12th. We're actually having a town hall of some sort, and that is particularly looking at financial aid. And we're having students and the actual staff members meet, so that the students can tell the staff members what are the issues. And then we're going to create a financial aid student panel of 4 students who will actually be integral in how we enhance our customer service. So I'm not saying this just to give you an answer. I'm actually telling you we're doing these things. And the first one is slated for November 12th.
So they'll be back at that time?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Other
question?
I was just wondering if our student trustee
was... Can you please turn your microphone on?
I was just curious if the student trustee was engaged, or you know, how you would get students to participate. And you know,
I think he's been a part of the communication with Mr. Gary Sosedo.
Okay, yes.
Yes.
Gary Sosedo, Jim Marsh.
Yes.
Mike.
Sorry. Yes, for the March.
Yeah.
But so
basically the March.
Okay,
the march takes 2 folds. This is a group of students who are interested in what we call the national indebtedness and the processes of financial aid.
Yes.
And then it's also an opportunity for the students at UDC to engage the actual financial aid office.
Okay.
So we're not going to speak to the national component as much as we're going to speak to the internal issues relative to our student engagement.
Yes. I'm familiar. I did receive some communication from Gary Sosedo, I believe.
Yeah, Sosedo. Yes.
Sosedo, and And I wasn't certain if it was something that the university was, I didn't understand the dynamics, that there was a relationship already with.
Yeah, there is. And so we're meeting on November 12th.
Okay.
And we're going to have that town hall is what I actually call it.
Okay.
And we'll try to hammer it out then.
Awesome. But I did commit that I would support and be a part of it. I just didn't understand the involvement.
Thanks. Thanks to Wyatt.
All right.
Oh, yeah, please.
So a couple of things. One, we're very focused on what's happening in this unit because, you know, I've visited classes, we've met with student leaders, and it's clear that once they get here, they enjoy the experience, but it's the process of getting through here that has been a challenge. And then, in addition, and this is to give some kudos to Dwight, You know, we had for the first time in a long time, high school counselors came to campus this past week, and we listened to them about what they thought the challenges were, and they were there, the entire leadership team. But at the end of the day, they thought it was a very positive experience and actually have started to reach out now to develop relationships with this office. And then the final thing is that the reason this is, one of the reasons this is such a high priority is because all of the academic programs that are in the line to be brought online, we can't do it until we get off of this probationary status with financial aid. So there's a lot riding on this work, but we think Dwight is on top of it with the team that's working with Troy.
And we anticipate probation when?
After the, go ahead.
Spring of the following year. So everything will take effect at 17. So they come on the 16th, they do the audit, they give us the feedback, they give us a period to make remediation, if allowed, but they usually do, and then the action or the act takes place the following year. So they tell us the following year where we are. Continued provisional status, or off of it, or heightened cash management, either one of those things.
Okay. I just didn't want any rumors out there that students may not get their money in September.
I'm sorry?
I was concerned so that there wouldn't be misinterpreted to mean that some students wouldn't have access to money because we didn't have it. Thank you. Questions? Okay. Next.
Next is budget pressures. We're going to hand this over to the money people. But we got our mark from the mayor, which is the amount of money we have to work with next year, and it wasn't we weren't as excited about it as we had hoped to be, but they'll give you the details. And the bottom line is that, you know, the message we've been sending downtown is that there are ways to cut budgets without actually cutting budgets. And because of the increased expenses and mandated costs that we've had to pick up that hasn't been paid for by the district, you know, we're going to have some budget challenges as we put together this upcoming budget year. But we'll let Troy and Don give you the details.
So thank you, Mr. President. It's Troy Stovall, Chief Operating Officer. So historically, and particularly with Don's leadership since Don has been here, one of the bigger challenges that the university has faced has been how it's managed this idea of depreciation. And our depreciation for this year, if you look back at the statements that Don presented a few moments ago, is a little under $4.5 million, and that's about what it's going to be for this year. When the new student center comes online, it's going to be $6 million total for the full year. In the past, the way we've managed it is, quite frankly, on the back end. In other words, we have waited till the end of the year and then found lapsed dollars, in other words, dollars that were not spent by the operations of the institution to pay for depreciation. If there's any question, that's not the way you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to actually budget for depreciation. It is considered a non-cash charge, but it's still it is part of your operating for the organization. So we believe that we should start to better manage that on the upfront. I know the president was speaking about fiscal 17, but we first have to deal with fiscal 16. So the first part of this conversation is about how we've had to move funds around and reduce budgets in order to make fiscal 16 work. And part of that was because of this desire to manage depreciation up front. I'm going to speak more about depreciation when we get into fiscal 17. So allow me that, Mr. Chairman, to speak more about depreciation. We also wanted to, again, with the new president being here, allow for to create, frankly, some funds so that we could invest in Vision 2020 and begin that investment to begin finding ways to find alternate revenue streams or provide better efficiencies in how we manage the place. So we wanted to create that. And quite honestly, I think as this committee and the full board knows, we have reduced significantly over the last years the NPS budget for our units. And as we looked at 16, a number of units, quite frankly, just frankly would not have been able to get through the year at those levels. And so when you add all that up, Mr. Chairman, there was a need for us to adjust fiscal 16. Again, we're not asking for any increase. We went in internally, and people have adjusted their budgets accordingly so we could put these priorities into the fiscal 16 budget. So I think Mr. Terry Prescott is here. and I'll allow him to walk you through whatever details you want. We're now, just so everyone has a point of reference, we're looking at pages 8 and 9 in your presentation. Mr. Prescott.
Okay, I'm
Terry
Prescott.
Mike.
Hello? Okay. I'm Terry Prescott, Assistant Provost for Academic Administration and Chair of the University Budget Committee. One of the first major tasks in building the FY17 budget involved an assessment of the budget pressures that might already exist in 16. You might be asking yourself the question, why might there be budget pressures issued at the very start of the academic year, of the fiscal year? And to kind of understand that, I think it's helpful just to flip back to look at the main issues that the board faced in approving the FY16 budget. In FY2016, the projection for the revenues was very flat, that in fact, actually, that they would decrease slightly by about $500,000. So FY16 was going to mean there would be less dollars, less revenue. Then there were several non-discretionary expenses that would increase in FY16. We gave these expenses the title of Tier 1 expenses, and the expenditure increases would be would have to be accommodated in that reduced FY16 budget, meaning there's less money to cover them. Those Tier 1 items included cost of living for AFSCME and OCFO. Don would let me leave that out. The 801 lease escalations, student center operating of funds. There were some accreditation issues, National Science Foundation compliance issues, and additional dollars for outside counsel. And Troy will be talking more about Tier 1 expenses as they affect FY17. These Tier 1 expenses for 16 came to $3.7 million, and even after adjusting for the RIF, you know, we had some savings from the RIF, we're faced with $2.8 million of additional expenses with a reduced fiscal year budget. Then the approach that we took toward adjusting the budget to fit those in was, as Troy mentioned, to reduce the non-personal services budgets of units across the board, except for the fixed cost areas. And this resulted in NPS budgets being reduced by as much as about 20%. So we knew this meant that there are going to be some issues in going into FY16, and the budget office received received several requests from units who were facing budget pressures starting the fiscal year. But as you see in your handout, we've approved $1.2 million for three units, primarily facilities, procurement, and athletics. And I might add that they really asked for more than that, but that's what we agreed to. The second major area of this budget pressure, Troy just mentioned, which was depreciation. There's no FY2016 budgetary funding was allocated to cover the cost of depreciation, which, as he mentioned, was about $4.5 million. Historically, the primary funding source used to cover depreciation costs had been lapsed personal funding, personal services funding. That is, any positions that were vacant any time during the 12-month fiscal year created some lapsed savings. The CFO used approximately about $3 million a year from that to address the depreciation issue. Decision was made that the university would begin in FY16 budgeting for depreciation, and we're starting with $1 million. The last item in our pressures, not technically a pressure, with a new president and no funding available for him to address priorities, particularly in Vision 2020, was decided to set aside $500,000 for that purpose. So the total FY16 budget pressures come to $2.7 million. All of the units, all the major units were given that across the board, 2.7% reduction of their budgets. They have responded and submitted to the budget office. The budget office is doing their final analysis on those. And in your handout, you will see the actual reductions for each major unit.
The 2.7 across the board, typically, again, it's an easy way to do it, but very often where good programs get impacted negatively, and maybe those where there's more than 2.7, you know, sort of just get off the hook. I understand that in the immediate need, this is one way to do it, but I would hope that, I guess let me ask, is there a plan that in as you move forward, you'll be able to have the kind of information
no
that
doubt.
Would allow you to
right.
deal with issues per department and not just across the board?
No doubt. So this was because of, we were already into the fiscal year. We were already, 2 months into the fiscal year. So this was, I hate to say it, the most expedient way to do it. There's no other way to kind of describe it. But the reality of it is, and we do know, and we looked at historical spending at individual units. So we've seen what units, if you will, overspent or underspent in previous years. And so, to your point, we'll take all that into account. We're about to have this conversation in a few moments, Mr. Chairman, about fiscal 17, and this is exactly the kind of conversation we've got to have with fiscal 17.
This is all in NPS
reductions? No, combination.
No. Actually, some of the units, there's no way some of the units could have reduced their NPS budgets any greater. So you will see a lot of funded vacant positions have been included in these reductions.
Yes, ma'am. That's exactly correct. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to drop off. I just want to let you know. I'm sorry.
Okay, Joe, thanks for joining us. Did you have any questions before you leave?
No. I was able to hear everything. It looks like everything is ready. I'm waiting, obviously, for the discussion on the dotted line and all those other things. But we're going to let it go forward.
Okay, thank you, trustee.
Thank you.
Do we have any, or have you looked at yet about how many personnel reductions and where they will come from?
Now, with the 2.7, mm-hmm. but there are not going to be any filled personnel reductions.
So you're taking vacancies?
Right, there'd be vacancies, and once the budget office finalizes the analysis, we'd be able to identify the total number of funded positions that were eliminated.
But let me clarify, there is a process by which if there's a critical need, does someone then have the option to
yes.
come?
No doubt. They have.
Okay.
Just to be clear about the process, we knew coming into this year we would have a budget deficit. So they went through a budget reduction process that reduced the budget out of NPS funds. After that happened, going into this year, we knew that procurement, facilities, and athletics were going to need more money, right? And that added up to, and then you take the Vision 2020 money, and that's about $2.7 million. So the across-the-board cut went across the board, but then that was used to enhance the budgets of the units that we knew would have to have their budgets enhanced. So in a sense, there was a process to decide, because a lot of people had requests for budget enhancements. So in a sense, there was a process on where to do those enhancements through this budget reduction across the board. So that even, for example, facilities, they did the across-the-board cut, and then the enhancement was put back in afterwards, if that follows. Now, that is this year's budget we just finished talking about.
Correct.
Yeah, we're moving to 17.
Yes, sir. So let me set the tone. We've been spending a lot of time really trying to buy time for us to lay the groundwork for the future of the University of the District of Columbia by getting the folks downtown to understand the real budget pressures that we face going into next year. And we've had many conversations with everybody from the deputy mayor to the people that run the budget office for the city to almost every council person. But when the process starts, which was yesterday, when we got our mark from the mayor, what she basically did, or what the administration basically did, was give us the budget we had last year, which did not include $3.5 million in operating funds, because that was put in as one-time money, but did give us $1.5 million in inflationary increases, right? So that at the end of the day, we actually have less money to work with this year than we did last year, because when they ran the formula, they had to take out the $3.5 million. Now, this is the beginning of the process, so it starts there. Then there's a lot of conversation between now and the time that the actual budget is submitted to the council. And then once it gets to the council, that's a whole different set of conversations that we'll be working on every step of the way. But as it is right now, with what we have, we not only have to deal with the 2.7% that we worked with this year, but going into next year, if nothing changes, that would be an additional 5% or so reduction, which is a huge number for us to have to work with. Now, you know, we're doing worst-case scenarios, but we're planning for the worst. We're working for the best over the course of the next couple of months, but that's where we are. And Troy and Don are going. I'll answer any questions you have, but Troy and Don will give you a little more detail about what we're talking about.
Can I ask a quick question on point of information? Sure. How much is that 5% equivalent to?
So when you put it all together, we're talking about an $8 to $10 million hole in next year's budget. Am I right about that number?
Okay.
Yeah, it's about an $8 to $10 million hole. Oh, go ahead, Charlie.
No, so allow me a few minutes because I know we're trying to get to. We have another committee meeting. Allow me and Don and Mr. Rexford and Mr. Prescott, please help me at any point along the way here. Allow me, Mr. Chairman and committee members, to do a little bit of historical context here so you understand what's been happening, because these budget pressures are historical and they have become compounded on us. So let's start with the COLAs, the cost of living increases that are automatically happen. Over the last just 3 years, that's equated to almost $2 million. Just from fiscal 14, 15, and 16, $2 million of increases, which have not been funded by the district, but other agencies have gotten some of their COLAs funded. If you look at the escalations around the 801 North Capitol lease over the last several years, that number, from fiscal 13 through fiscal 15, is about $1.3 million of costs that, again, we have had to absorb within our budget here. At the university. Let me now talk about depreciation. So we have come to understand, and Don, again, has helped us a lot on this piece, we do not own these buildings. There are only two buildings that we own. One is the law school building. The other is the president's house. Yet we are taking depreciation on these buildings. That's point one. I think point two that's important for this committee to know is that we are the only agency that is taking depreciation on our buildings. So we are working. So if you look at page 11 in your document, committee members, as I said earlier, our depreciation for next fiscal year, when you add the new student center in, will be $6 million. Over the course of the last several years, if you add up all the depreciation, you're looking at $13 million of non-cash charges that we have taken. So I don't say these numbers to scare or to, but as points of fact, to understand that we are working to identify how we can deal with this depreciation, looking how we can deal with these cost increases, and having a realistic budget that shows what it really costs to operate the University of the District of Columbia. But so I will stop there because I want to kind of end, frankly, on a little bit more positive note, because there are models that we are running, because I'm going to ask Mr. William Nelson to come up. Before I do that, Mr. Prescott or Mr. Rickford, do you want to add anything on anything that I talked about?
No,
Just to put it in perspective, of the 8 to 10 million hole that we talked about 6 of it is depreciation. So this is not a little issue, and we're peeling back the onion slowly but surely on how the finances work here. But it's really not clear to me why we're taking depreciation on buildings we don't own, right? So we're going to struggle with that, and Don, you know, we're pressing Don to press the people he's got to press to get the answer we're looking for. So,
to be a little bit more positive, two positive things I asked Mr. Nelson to come up. One of the things we've been looking at, our models that we've run in the past when we looked at revenue, this is on the revenue side, have frankly just been kind of a straight line looking at kind of general growth of that. But we really realized as we started looking at this that there, to say this simply, there's really revenue around retention and looking at cohorts much more and looking at our transfers, looking at if we can keep them. And the question we've been finding out and looking at is, what's the revenue impact of just increasing our retention by 1%? Just by 1%. What's the revenue impact? And I think the president, I think it probably at the board meeting, will talk about the Focus 14 effort that he has around getting at those freshmen, those first-time in college freshmen that were here in 2014, and getting them to the finish line in 2020. Again, there's clearly an academic reason to do that, but there's also a financial reason to do that as well. And so Mr. Nelson has been leading our efforts. I want to give him a few minutes, and I'm going to talk about one last point, Mr. Chairman.
Good evening. William Nelson, Associate Dean for Finance and Administration at the law school. What we're looking at, based on the president's direction, was opportunities kind of within the population that we have. We currently have about a 50% retention rate for first-time in college students here at the law school on an annual basis in year one. But when you look at that retention rate, we want to...
Before your dean collapses, it's not the law school. It's a 50% retention rate for the university, not the law school.
I will clarify that. I'll clarify that. See, Dean, no. The information that I'm sharing with you is university-wide, okay? I happen to work at the law school, but this project is a university-wide project.
We understood.
Okay. Thank you. So what we're looking at is some opportunity within the population we wanted to delve down. As we talked about historically, our revenue has kind of just been at a high level. Our projections have just been on total enrollment, and we haven't quite had the effort in enrollment management. We brought on Dwight last year, and we've been digging down in the numbers, basically. So what we found is within our numbers for our first-time, full-time students, what's happening between year one and two, while we have a 50% retention rate, we have a 33% retention rate for full-time to full-time. Many students come here and are fully enrolled in the university. And what we believe is that we can increase that full-time to full-time number within the population that we have. If, as we determine, kind of put our arms around those students on a regular basis in that first year, we can see some increased revenue and keep students on a full-time basis that helps them move towards graduation. So we're just trying to tie our financial planning to an actual enrollment plan, and that's kind of been a missing piece for a while, where we think that our dollars can go a little bit further because we have a more captive audience and have what will lead to a higher graduation rate. If students persist at a full-time rate, we believe we can increase graduation rates over time while increasing revenue in that same population. Now, I'll give you some shocking figures, just a little bit. Year two to year three, the picture's worse than 33%. Okay, like 9%. So we start out with a population of 300 full-time students, and in 2 years, we're down to 31 full-time students and 48 students out of the 300 that started. So we're losing them in that first 2 years. Numbers indicate if a person makes it past that second year to what we call the junior level, they're more likely to graduate, kind of past the point of no return, and see the finish line ahead. So that's really where we're trying to go. is work through those numbers and take advantage of our population. And we're working with the Enrollment Management Office to kind of make that happen.
Thank you. I appreciate the focus on not just retention, but retention with full-time status. The third piece of that puzzle may be arrival with sophomore status in the second year, and then arrival with junior level status. So just because you're full-time doesn't mean you passed all of your courses. And so I'm curious whether that analysis, or whether in the future that analysis could be done, because we've seen, for instance, at places like Georgia State that had a very steady retention rate for students. This was precisely the problem you've identified, is precisely the problem that they saw. It was steady retention rate, but students weren't graduating. When they looked, they saw that it was about credit accumulation. And when they intensified credit accumulation, they saw a doubling of graduation rate. It was really remarkable. It was not just retention, but retention with sophomore year status, and then the second year retention with junior year status. So thank you for raising, I think, two of the three very important variables. But if we could add that third one in, and if you have any data about that now, great. But otherwise, just in the future, it would be really helpful to track that as well.
Yeah, I think for the most part, the board is sort of informed about the impact of both retention and even more so with the federal government completion rates, which, again, we haven't addressed either. So we will remain optimistic that this is a way to bring in money, but you know, we look at the data over the last few years, you know, it's not much to be optimistic about. So I think we'll be looking at, you know, what specifically, when the time comes, what specifically will be done to ensure that this happens, because, you know, we know the data, what the data says, and I appreciate your bringing that forward.
I wonder if I remember last, I guess it was a year ago, when we talked about, you know, we have about 100 or so first-time, full-time students who enrolled in the university each year. And Dean Massey, I believe, was looking at some special program that targeted those 100 students. And I wonder if we have any information about what she's done, and if we saw any difference from that, you know, first year to second year in that 100 student cohort that she was talking about.
So a couple of things. One, we actually had in our convocation presentation a slide from Mr. Weiner about Georgia State, which made that exact point, and we emphasized that point about it's not just about retention, is about movement toward becoming a sophomore in your second year. And I just met with the deans about what they've done and what we want to do in this area. I looked at the fact book information. I didn't see a lot of movement in the retention field. And I don't think it's because they didn't have good ideas. I think they just hadn't latched on to getting the work done. So we're going to put together something we're calling Focus 14. And Focus 14 is going to focus on the first-time, full-time students that came in the 2014, because that's going to be the graduating class of 2020. And we've set a goal, and this is a public goal, to increase the graduation rate for that group to 25%, which is now 16%. And if you think about it, it's not a lot of students that we're talking about. So, you know, if you focus on those students, we ought to be able to make that happen. And that's going to do two things for us. One, it'll not only give us the model we need to address the broader population, but the other thing it'll do is change the perception problem we have with our graduation rate. Because if we can show an increased graduation rate, then people will start to look at us differently in terms of, even though we're only talking about 100 students a year, they'll start to look at us differently overall because of that public information. So that one we're deep into talking about, and I met with the deans and Dr. Petty just what was that, yesterday or the day before, right? Yesterday. So, and every 100 students is worth to us what, $500,000 or something, and just to put it in crass financial terms. And the trick is to turn as many part-time students into full-time students as we possibly can.
Just in general, you know, the historical presentation that you did, I think is one that the board was well aware of and that we've struggled with, you know, because we certainly have felt every year the impact of these things that are outside of our control. The mayor being able to negotiate union increases without giving us money to support that. That obviously has an impact on us every year. And I think all of that just speaks to the need we have to have more control over our own destiny. And I'm hoping that we are, you know, thinking about a strategy to help us accomplish that. Because we can't continue, even with all the things that you guys may be planning, if somebody else is in control of our financial destiny, we're still not going to be able to keep our heads above water. So we've got to gain more control over what we do. Just this formula doesn't work for us at the end of the day.
Yeah, you made a good point, Madam Chair. And again, we've had discussions about the need to accept the new words, but on the other hand, push them for action, because we've heard the words before. And so, but this is a good time. And you know, right now, this is the biggest game that we can play. So, you have to, yeah, we need to really
I do. I'll be.
Can I suggest something, though? I'm sorry. So, I also think, though, we should have a two-pronged strategy where, on the one hand, we're doing defense work and we're doing offense work. And on the defense side, I think part of that includes a very robust, work towards fundraising on the private side, where we're counterbalancing so that we're also gaining independence to a certain extent in a different way, so that we can manage how we use those funds and then be able to set money aside. And I know some of you don't think we can do that, but I do believe we can. And granted, it's been difficult because we don't have the best record on the planet, but it's not the worst either. And with all the changes that have taken place, I'm very confident and feeling pretty optimistic that we can start changing things.
Thanks for that comment. We're going to let the president comment on some of the things he's doing in terms of development.
Yeah, well, we have a list, and of course, Member Lemus is on the board of the foundation. The foundation has got some work to be done in order to be the kind of fundraising entity that we need it to be. Having said that, though, we've asked the chairman of the council to increase the match to $2 million over $1 million, because after conversations with the dean of the law school, we're confident that, you know, she can do a chunk of it and we can cover the rest. So we're going to take that and move with it. And then in addition, I actually have dinner with the chairman of the foundation and the vice chair. I think she's the vice chair. And the executive director of the foundation to start to talk about how we can piece together minimally effective fundraising effort in the short term until we can get the infrastructure in place to start doing big fundraising. But the other thing is this, if I could just say it. You really do have to have something to sell. And, you know, people are waiting for us to develop a cohesive vision and plan for the university over the long run. And I really do believe that if we can get that done and make it clear that everybody on our end is behind what we're selling, I think it's a sellable product that we can go out and raise some money around. So you got to do the right thing in the right order.
Well, and again, most of us talked about the great things that are going on here, but we're still up against what appears to be the old image.
We have a perception issue, yeah. You know, and at the bottom line, it's the perceived value of the degree, which is really what we're here to do, and our effort is going to be to change that perception. That's what all of this is about.
I also feel that perhaps part of our proactive strategy is to build a kind of an outreach campaign that starts breaking down those negative perceptions.
Absolutely.
I shared with the president, this will be something that the dean of the law school will like to hear. I have a few proteges, and one of them just enrolled in Georgetown Law. And she said that she has someone that Georgetown poached from here in her class, and that individual said UDC is better, that the instructors are better, the nurturing that they get is better, that overall the education she got at UDC Law School was better than what she's getting at Georgetown. So it is the perception of what is valuable that is hurting us, and if we can fix that, I think it goes to what we're talking about here. You liked that, didn't you? And I know you did.
Yeah, if I could just add that, I mean, that's something we should celebrate, frankly. And the word that person gets, whether they transferred from here and completed their degree elsewhere or not, the word that the quality of what they got here was strong is precisely what's going to help. And it's true, we absolutely need to, you've been proselytizing increasing graduation rates as much as anybody here, but it's also the quality of the education that we provide. And that's really ultimately what's going to bring more people in and benefit students the most. So that's a very heartwarming story, and I think we should not lament the fact that that student didn't stay. We can work harder to make sure as many do as possible, but also we should celebrate that that perception. That's important. Thank you for sharing that.
Okay, again, thank you.
So we have two final points, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Actually, it's very relevant to this perception piece. So this board probably remembers a few years ago there was a consultant report from a group called Attain that laid out that our costs per FTE were significantly higher compared to other institutions. Our work, again, working with Don and Ms. Rick for the team, shows that, the measuring stick was an inaccurate measuring stick. The schools that they were looking at, number one, weren't land grant. Mm-hmm. Number two, did not have a community college. Mm-hmm. Number three, none of them were in the biggest urban area, all due respect, Mr. President, were the biggest urban area was Baton Rouge. And so there was not there just wasn't a fair comparison. The other thing, though, if you really do want to compare, if you look at the way the math works, the math takes the total cost that we spend and divide it by the number of FTEs. That's basically what it is. But if you look in that numerator, there are numbers that have nothing to do with the denominator. As an example, the $2 million that we spend for the land grant. And there are other numbers like in workforce. Again, the workforce numbers are in the numerator, but has nothing to do with the denominator. So very quickly, if I may, just a quick math. We'll plan on coming to the board and showing our analysis around this. And we've got other things we've got to do with the groups like IPAS to make sure we have an accurate reflection of these numbers. But if you look at, it was $31,000 per FTE. If you look at the numbers that we're looking at right now, we think that number's more $27,000 to $28,000 per FTE. To context that, the Attain report had the average of those schools that we said were not comparables, but let's just assume that they were comparables, was $21,000 per FTE. If you inflate that by the HEPI index, which is the Higher Education Price Index, if you inflate that over the 4 years till now, that 21 becomes 25 to 26. And so, long-winded way to say that we are comparably, if you really look at the real cost to educate, but that's getting out there, and we had this conversation. We went to speak to the mayor and the budget folks, and they did tell us that perception was there. Now, it has been there recently, but it has been there historically. So we have work to do to deal with that. And let me close on this point. That doesn't mean that we don't need to find ways to better spend and be more efficient about what we do. But, again, it's a perception of that cost because of how the math worked and the comparables that were being used.
Mr. Chair, also I would think that we need to make sure that the students have more pride in their university in terms of what would make them think that the grass is greener on the other side. Why do you have to get to the other side to find out you already had it good before you left? So I think that's a matter of getting their mindset changed.
Thank you. And again, we've talked about the marketing. It's not on tonight's agenda, but at some point, because we know there are great things going on here at the university, at the community college, causes, law school, business school, I mean, you name it. But we have that image, and we'll have to work on that.
Let me just say, though, to your point, I'm happy to hear, that what you've said with respect to the Attain report, because, again, I want it on the record that when that report was presented, the points that you made are points that were raised
exactly
by the board.
Yeah.
We questioned the numbers. we ask specifically about the, you know, the numbers in the numerator and the denominator. So let's just be clear, you know, it's a political agenda we were fighting there. And there wasn't much interest in making the points that you made. And so I'm happy that you have the backup to support that, because I had no way of knowing where to go to get the numbers, you know.
Mr. Chairman.
And I think that helps.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, Barrington Scott, I also want to say that the approach of having the high school area counselors come to the university, that is so big that you can't even imagine. Because the word that I'm getting from the high schools is that it's the counselors that were telling the students or laying that bad image prior to. And so by having them up on the campus, letting them see what's going on, taking them around, giving them our vision for 2020, and with the excellent help that we'll be getting from our professors to change that around, to work from that 2014 moving forward to graduation. And then just the courtesy, as you put earlier, the courtesy when you come on campus. And then I have to say it all the time, my president's new Firebird Nation theme. Everywhere I go, I tell him, are you going to be a part of the Firebird Nation? And so we have to put ourselves out in the community and let people know that there is a change, that UDC is changing. And the change comes from how people perceive you, first of all, and what you say about the university and how you put that back into the community. But that piece with this, with the counselors, is very important. Thank you so much.
No, if Trustee Scott, we did a survey of the counselors that were here, and a number of them said their perception of the institution changed because of their time here. So we agree. So my last point, page 13 shows the budget timeline. Oh, I apologize.
Just 2 points. I think clearly the comparables need to be comparable. I think if it becomes what a report says and then we have questions and it's our statement against somebody else's, we're going to always end up in this battle. I think we have to be honest and try to figure out where our cost per student is relative to others. And if it is high, acknowledge that and figure out why it is and what we might do. And I hear you saying that. There are methodologies that are used nationally, though, the Delta Cost Project, to look at instructional cost per student. There are ways of isolating these things. And I think, you know, I would just encourage, rather than our coming up with the best reasons why we may be different from others, for us to try to adopt a methodology that can lead to comparables with others. Because I do think one of the challenges we face is that when people raise other comparable institutions, we say, well, we don't have comparables. And frankly, in higher education, we're never going to win that argument. There are institutions that are like enough to every institution in the country for you to say, and we, you know, we heard a little bit at our retreat about that, both on graduation rates and in terms of cost per student. I'm not saying that the reports out there are fair, but I am saying that we should try to adopt a methodology that allows us to really look at ourselves benchmarked against others, because that's the way the outside world will perceive us. In addition to this good work of bringing students on here to see what's really happening instead of letting the lore go out there that's inaccurate, I think raising the graduation rates, that's what the country's going to see, that's what people are going to see, and that's what counselors are going to look at for students. That's the information they have when they're advising students as to where to go to school. And then in terms of public investments, the cost per student, trying to figure out a methodology that we feel is fair and acknowledging where we can improve. I think finding that middle ground to say there are comparables, we are willing to hold ourselves to a standard that is related to others and that's fair to us. Chair Kreider, I couldn't agree with you more. That's fair. But I think that's a step in the direction that both for our investors at the public level, the government investors, and for students, for our potential customers, will really stand us in good stead. So I would encourage us to try to find the comparables we're comfortable with, have some neutral methodology that we're willing to say, yes, we can improve, and this is what we're going to do it. Oh. That's fair.
Okay, we're going to have one comment here. You're going to get 1 minute, and then we're going to adjourn the meeting. Yes.
What I was going to say was that we just need, this is Gwen Lewis, we just need to keep in mind that our student body here, there's a lot of intervention here. There are a lot of students that we bring in that need remedial studies. That's more money. And that's one reason why the costs may be a little higher. But there are others, I know. And we do, I do agree with your statement, but I'm just saying, let's make sure we remember the student population that we're dealing with.
You absolutely have to control for that. I agree with that.
Well, we thought that, yeah. Yeah, all right. You can say something. You can close.
Yeah, just real quickly, to speak to Josh's point. Comparables are important, but, you know, the truth is we are a very unique institution in that we're the only urban, truly urban land grant in the country. So finding comparables is a challenge, although it's important. The other thing is that I don't know if you noticed the Brookings piece that came out last week that talked about the federal report card, and it graded the value added by the education of the different institutions based on the salaries that they make 10 years out. And we got a 93 out of 100, and the only other school in the area that got higher than us was George Washington. So, you know, I mean, so we are a unique place, and we do add value, but there's a cloud around us that we have to clear up in order for people to understand who we are and what we do.
Yeah, I appreciate this discussion. again, we know what the issue is. We know the politics behind it. We have a great opportunity now with our new president and the unified folks here on the campus to move forward, and we're going to have to take advantage of it. All right.
The last point, yes, sir, is page 13, just to show you the timeline of which I think everyone is aware of. We actually ought to receive the mark. We thought we were going to receive the mark on the 10th. We actually, as the printout already mentioned, we have the mark. You see it actually on page 12 in the middle column there. It's $68.9 million was our mark. December the 8th is your board session where we will bring back the budget for approval there, and then we actually have to submit it to the city on December the 12th. That's it.
Okay, thank you, and I want to thank the staff for the great input presented.
Do we need to recommend that this budget go forward to the board?
We don't. We don't really have a budget. It's sort of just an update. Okay, we're going again. Our apologies to our committee that's now been delayed, but let's formally adjourn. Move for adjournment. Second, properly moved. Second, any readiness?
All right. Come back.
Anyway, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.